From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you, Giles.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
How you doing, eh? I'm doing all right, thank you.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And Dr. Vernon Coleman joins the very first show of 2021 a little bit later on. The doc will be with me in hour two. I'm sure you'll be interested to hear that. Lots to talk about, so I won't dwell on it. Before that, though, the criminologist and the lecturer and the author, Stuart Waiton, who's a great public speaker. Stuart will be on to talk about a brand new article of his in Spiked Online about grooming gangs. You don't want to miss that. We'll also chat with Stuart about, well, a few other things as well. Yeah, that's right. It is good to be back. How are you? You can join me on Twitter or tweet me from Twitter. I'm still on Twitter. It's at 1 Richie Allen. That's the number 1 Richie Allen, at 1 Richie Allen. You all right then, are you? Are you well rested? Are you? Do you have a good Christmas? A good holiday period? And you're in fine fettle now, are you? Good, I'm glad to hear it. I am. Monday, January 4th, 2021. How long before I say 2020? Give it a few minutes. I normally get through half of the first show before making that mistake. So yes, all is well. It's been very, very, very cold, of course, in the north, the northwest. Well, pretty much in the UK in general. And Salford is no exception. It's freezing. I say this every year and I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Not a good time to be sleeping rough. And if you encounter anyone who's sleeping rough and you do have the price of a cup of coffee or something to eat or even a blanket, do that. Please, do it for me. All right. You heard Giles there in the news talking about the Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He said, did Giles, that Boris Johnson will make a televised address at 8 o'clock this evening. He will. It's inevitable. The country is about to be plunged into another lockdown, a national lockdown. Johnson spoke earlier on. We won't hear from him, will we? No. He spoke behind a face covering, or from behind a face covering, and was almost impossible to understand. But he said he would be announcing new measures later on. You also heard Giles talk about Scotland. Johnson was usurped. Is that how you say that? Usurped? I think that's how I say it. By Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon. Cranky herself. Not for the first time. She's upstaged Boris Johnson. She announced, as you heard on the news, that Scotland would be plunged into a national lockdown from midnight tonight. From midnight. Let's hear from Nicola Sturgeon. A bit more than you heard in the news.
We are now seeing a steeply rising trend of infections. Indeed, it is no exaggeration to say that I am more concerned about the situation we face now than I have been at any time since March last year. Stay home, save lives, protect the NHS. If we do this, we give the vaccine the time it needs to get ahead and ultimately win this race. I know that the next few weeks will be incredibly difficult. I'm sorry to ask for further sacrifices after 9 long months of them, but these sacrifices are necessary. And the difference between now and last March is that with the help of vaccines, we now have confidence that these sacrifices will pave the way to brighter days ahead. So for everyone's sake and for everyone's safety, please stick with it and stay at home.
Stay at home. Jimmy Cranky there. And to reiterate, Boris Johnson will be speaking on national telly at 8 o'clock. He said earlier there was no question his government would announce stricter measures to prevent the spread of the virus. And again, I won't play that because the great big blancmange, the great big blancmange, was speaking to the media wearing a face covering, specially designed one to carry his 5 chins. And you couldn't understand a word he was saying, honestly. Think of Nancy Pelosi that time, inhaling the mask. Yeah, big barrel of monkey spunk, Johnson. 8 o'clock tonight, all channels. Attention, all channels. Jimmy jumped the gun. Little bollocks, isn't she, Nicola Sturgeon? Always trying to upstage our Prime Minister. Anyway, there was a fairly strange exchange, a mad exchange, between Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, and a reporter from Sky called Sam Coates. Coates has already asked Starmer twice whether he would close primary schools from tomorrow and gotten nowhere. And then, just listen to a bit of this.
We need to take action this week on national restrictions, and that needs to include schools. That requires...
All primary schools shut tomorrow.
Well, shutting schools without a national plan is not going to work. You need a national set of restrictions.
Why can't you give a yes or no answer to that? Shut primary schools tomorrow. Is that your plan?
You need national restrictions. School closures will inevitably have to be part of that. If that can be... I've said to the Prime Minister to get this plan in place today, but certainly...
I don't understand what your plan is. What do you need to do before shutting primary schools, and why can't that happen tomorrow? Why do you want to keep schools open?
We need a national set of restrictions. It is inevitable that closing schools is going to be part of that. It's going to have to be part of that.
But I don't understand what that means. How soon and under what, or if not, under what circumstances?
As soon as possible, we need the national plan in place. And if that can be done today or tomorrow, then we will support the Prime Minister in that.
But there are certain circumstances in which schools should stay open.
No, I'm saying there should be national restrictions, and that inevitably will include school closures. They need to go together. And we need a plan, therefore, for working parents. We need a plan for children so that they can learn at home. We need a plan to get schools reopened again as soon as possible. And that brings me back to the vaccine, because...
I don't want to leave schools because I don't understand your position. Do you think primary schools should shut tomorrow, and what are the conditions under which they should stay open?
Just answer the question, Starmer.
I think there should be national restrictions as soon as possible. I called for them yesterday to start today.
What does that mean? Well, I don't understand.
I called for national restrictions yesterday. They should be put in place as soon as possible. It is inevitable, as part of those national restrictions, that schools will have to close. The two go together, and I'm saying this should happen as soon as possible.
So do you think that schools could be reopened for mass vaccine rollout?
No. We need to get the virus under control. We need to protect the NHS, which is under a huge amount of strain this January. And we need a programme for the vaccine to be rolled out. The sooner that is done, let's have a vaccine programme that gets us up to 2 million a week within the next week or two, and 4 million a week in the early part of February. That's what we need more than anything else, because that is the light at the end of the tunnel.
The vaccine is the light at the end of the tunnel. Ah, jab me, you know. Jab me. Jab the effing bejesus out of me. Jab me twice. Jab me thrice. Jab me in the buttocks. Jab me in the knees. Jab me in the arms. Because I can't take any more of it. Personally, I can't take any more of it. So 2 million jabs a week. And then that rising to 4 million jabs a week by February. That's Starmer's plan. Keir Starmer. Now the same reporter, Sam Coates, or Samuel Coates, as he would be if he was in Spain, spoke to former Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt. Hunt said we should lock down. Well, we should lock down till Easter. Yeah.
Do you need to vaccinate all those who could potentially die if they get the virus? And it looks like we'll be able to reach most of those people by Easter. And I think that's why I think this time, funnily enough, it's an easier decision to agree to a version of a national lockdown because there is that light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, let's lock down till Easter. And by Easter, those of the population most likely to die if they get coronavirus, which is basically nobody, will be vaccinated and then we can open up. He did make me laugh earlier in the day. Did Jeremy Hunt. He was on with the BBC News anchor Simon McCoy, who's a proper douchebag, is McCoy. He's dreadful. Have a listen.
Isn't the best message the most clear one, and that is stay at home?
Yeah. This is your media today, as it was yesterday, and as it was last week, last month, last year, and 5 years ago. Don't challenge any of it. Demand that we be locked down. Isn't it the right thing to do to just tell people to stay indoors and be dominant once and for all?
Isn't the best message the most clear one, and that is stay at home?
Well, I think that will be effectively the message. The tier system had its ups and downs, but...
What was that? They're just laughing at us now.
The tier system had its ups and downs, but...
The tier system had its up and downs. And in other news, escalators have their ups and downs and stairs have their ups and downs.
It's clearly got to be changed now because the highest tier, tier four, isn't controlling the new strain of the virus.
Amazing. Hunt, former health secretary, says to BBC presenter Simon McCoy, tier four isn't controlling the virus. At no point does Simon McCoy ask the question that is rattling around his empty noggin. The obvious question, what's the fucking point of locking the fuck down society and people if it doesn't matter, if it doesn't stop transmission? And guys like Hunt will say, well, it did back last year, it did. Of course, the truth is, when they say lockdown worked last year, it reduced transmission. No, what happened was during lockdown last year, during the first national lockdown, they weren't testing as many people with the redundant PCR test. When you are not testing somebody with the dubious, as I said, redundant, worthless PCR test, you're not getting as many positives. False positives, mostly. Oh, God. A journalist, my very modest kingdom for a journalist.
So either we scrap the tier system or we change it. But the highest tier in a tier system has to control the virus. Yeah. And so that's one of the things that I'm expecting to change in the announcement this evening.
And you see, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. What they will do is plunge the country into a complete lockdown this evening. There won't be as many people getting tested as a result of that. And they will say in 3 or 4 or 5 weeks' time, see, the R number is flatlining. So the lockdown must be working. It's very, very sinister and twisted and evil. But you got to give them a little bit of credit for it as well. Very simple. But of course, it would be annihilated. It wouldn't survive, it wouldn't thrive, it wouldn't succeed if one or two national reporters did their jobs, you know. But they're all shit, every one of them. Listen to Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid coming to an ad break this morning on Good Morning Britain.
So if you are feeling a bit low, we're here to keep you going throughout the morning. It is, you know, there is hope on the horizon. There is light on the horizon and at the end of the tunnel. We've just got to keep going. We've just got to keep our distance. We've got to wash our hands. We've got to wear our masks.
And remember, before we go to the break, you're not alone.
Yeah, he's been listening to Dr. Vernon Coleman, I think, Piers Morgan there. That's propaganda doesn't cover that. Those two arseholes had Matt Hancock on the programme this morning and again failed utterly in their duty to hold him to account. There they are going, crashing into ad breaks, telling you very, very nurse. It's one flew over the cuckoo's nest, this, isn't it? It's the nurse, the station. Play the boring, mundane, drive you absolutely, I don't know, make you acquiescent, play the horrible, say it for me, what is it, classical music, and hand out the medication. That's what it is, really. And former pathologist John Lee has had enough of this. Here he is on Talk Radio this morning.
If we live in a free democratic society, openness and debate is one of the things that's the hallmark of our society. And yet the government have been unwilling to debate with me or anybody else who's sceptical of their claims about what they're doing in any way. The BBC, for example, it seems to me have been essentially censored and become a propaganda channel. Anybody who supports the government narrative is on. Anybody who doesn't, you simply don't hear from them. Mm. The fact is, it's worse than the fact that the government can't produce evidence to support lockdowns. As I say, there is much, much evidence on many different levels to show that these lockdowns are not only ineffective in controlling the virus. Viral control is largely a myth. But actually they're causing direct harm. So you know, every young person in their 20s or 30s who kills themselves, it seems to me, is blood on the government's hands. They are, you know, not only, well, they're only following one type of science. There is an approach that can be used to find the right way through a situation when you don't have all the details and when you don't know it. And that is to actually involve many different professionals from many different walks of life with many different views. And the politician's job is to synthesize those. Unfortunately, what we've had for the last 9 months is that the government have delegated essentially public decision making on this to the SAGE committee. So the entire country has been in thrall to a group of non-practicing doctors, as far as they can see, and scientists who are rather nerdy and totally banned by false models. And unfortunately, this has led us to the absolute travesty, you know, of keeping people safe that we've got, where it's actually doing the opposite, and they won't discuss it.
John Lee there, pathologist on Talk Radio. Very interesting that Sage members rather nerdy and bound by models which have proven to be false and ridiculous. Think of Niall Ferguson, who's not gone away either, by the way. It is 18 and a half minutes past five. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford here in the Northwest. A freezing cold Salford. Thanks for joining me. If you want to see what people are tweeting me, go to twitter.com and where it says search Twitter, input or enter Richie Allen Show. Oh, no, no, don't do that. Jesus, Richie. Input one Richie Allen, all one word. That's the number one Richie Allen, all one word. If you do that, you'll get to see what other people are tweeting to me. Don't forget, Dr. Vernon Coleman joins the programme a bit later on, second hour. Before that, Stuart Waiton, Abertay University lecturer, author and criminologist, written a very interesting piece in Spiked Online today, and that's about grooming gangs. Do you know about this? Do you? Do you know about it? Well, you might remember that just over 2 years ago, the former Home Secretary, a guy called Sajid Javid, commissioned a report into the characteristics of grooming gangs. You might remember that, you might not. It reported just before Christmas, and, well, there's been a bit of controversy about the conclusions, or at least how those conclusions have been reported by the media here, namely The Guardian and The Independent. So we'll get into that and more with Stuart Waiton fairly soon. On the vaccine, by the way, and all of this talk about let's just lock the hell down, let's do even more damage to people's businesses than we've done before, let's furlough people again, let's add billions of pounds more to the debt that, of course, you and me will be asked to pay in the very near future. Let's wreck the lives of children. Let's kill God knows how many people as a result of the lockdown itself. Okay? The government's own conservative, no pun intended, estimate was last year the lockdown itself, not coronavirus, but the lockdown would lead to 200,000 deaths, mental health, suicide, all manner of things, people not getting treatment for things they need to be treated for. So let's do all of that again until we get the vaccine. Until enough people get the vaccine. I'm not sure if you know this, but in the Sunday Times, this Sunday just gone, I was reading it, so I was, on sofa, curled up with dogs, and it published, and I don't have it to hand, but the Sunday Times published a poll that alleged 25% of adults surveyed in this country, surveyed last week, 25% have said they will not take the vaccine, giving many different reasons for that. You're not talking about vaccine skeptics. You're not talking about people who have been, I don't know, reluctant to take vaccines in the past, but many people giving the reason that they're very concerned about the speed with which the vaccine came into being. I'd rather let other people take it first, you know. One or two people mentioning swine flu, of course, and narcolepsy and so on. So that'll be interesting, won't it? I know in Spain, where I lived for the best part of 9 years, they've proposed in Spain, I think you probably know this, a national register of those who refuse to take the vaccine. Nothing creepy about that at all, eh? Eh? Okay. 22 minutes past the hour. It's time for a tune. I don't know what to play. I've got The Animals in Cart 1. I've got the Spencer Davis Group in Cart 2. I've got a bit of Bruce Springsteen in Cart 3. I think we'll go with The Animals. Why not? This is kind of appropriate or kind of apt. Welcome back to the Richie Allen Radio Show. How you doing?
In this dirty old park, somewhere, baby.
The Animals, we got to get out of this place. Before we do go to Stuart, we can't not mention, of course, as you heard Giles in the news say back at the top of the hour, that Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, it was announced today by a judge in London that he cannot be extradited to the United States. The judge blocked the request because of concerns over his health, his mental health, and the risk of him committing suicide in the United States. You know that the US says that it wants him because of the publication of thousands of classified documents, of course, in 2010, 2011. They say, or the government says there, he broke the law and endangered lives. This is a nonsense, of course. You and I know that. And he's had a pretty rough time of it for many years. The Ecuadorian embassy, Belmarsh Prison, where he's now being held. He's gone back there. Judge has said in London he cannot be extradited because of his health and concerns he might commit suicide in the US. Here's his partner, Stella Morris, speaking to the assembled media shortly after the announcement. Stella Morris. I think we have that. We have.
Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognised the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision. It continues to want to punish Julian and make him disappear into the deepest, darkest hole of the US prison system for the rest of his life.
Yes, Stella Morris there. And I did hear Peter Hitchens, the writer and broadcaster, speaking to Talk Radio earlier on. And Hitchens said that it's a bit of a bloody nose for the journalists in this country and beyond, but in this country, who haven't supported Julian Assange, who haven't written about the outrageous situation that he found himself in. Embarrassing for journalists in the UK, said Peter Hitchens. I agree with that. I've never been the biggest fan of Julian Assange personally, but of course I never agreed with the man's basic house arrest at the Ecuadorian embassy, and of course I couldn't possibly agree with his extradition to the United States of America. I won't get into my misgivings about WikiLeaks and about Assange. I won't get into it today because I did a programme on it before. I did interview his partner in, I won't say partner in crime, that's wrong, but his successor at WikiLeaks, Kristen Rafsnan, in London a few years ago. It didn't go well. It was a bit of a spiteful interview. I always had the impression about Assange that Assange enjoyed the celebrity aspect of what he was doing. And I believe that Assange particularly didn't care too much about protecting the sources that gave him the information that he subsequently published. And that's how I've felt about Julian Assange. But of course, I'm glad that he's not going to be extradited to the United States of America. And some very good friends of this programme over the years, people like Ray McGovern and others, they're not too thrilled about my stance on Assange, and they don't agree with me, but that's neither here nor there. I don't believe he should be extradited to the United States, and I believe he should be released on his own recognizance. He should be released now, back to his family. Leave the man alone. Right, 29 minutes past the hour. Should have Stuart Waiton in a moment. Again, Dr. Vernon Coleman will be on the radio programme in the second hour. You don't want to miss that. So much happening between lockdown announcements in Scotland today. More of it to come at 8 o'clock UK time this evening when Boris Johnson will be on the national airwaves, presumably flanked by Tweedledum, Tweedledee, or Jean-Claude Van Damme, or Van Tam, whatever his name is, and will announce that the UK, England, I suppose he has to say England, doesn't he, will be returning to full national lockdown or restrictions very soon, if not at midnight tonight, probably midnight tomorrow night. I don't know. Let's have another tune then. Why don't we? It's the first show back. We can have another tune and relax a bit. It's going to be a long week, I think. Was watching Notting Hill over the festive period and reminded what an absolutely brilliant song this is. So here it is. Spencer Davis Group on the Richie Allen Show. 5:30 it is. Stuart Waiton hopefully joining me in about 2 minutes' time. Spencer Davis Group, Give Me Some Lovin'. Stuart Waiton is with me. He will be with me in about 60 seconds' time. It's that time of year, you see, where people are still in that frame of mind where they don't know what day it is. I know this to be true. I've got to constantly remind myself at this time of year what actual day, not the date, but what the day is. That's what the holiday will do to you. Faisal. How you doing, Faisal? Faisal says, Richie, I never rated the whole Julian Assange thing as such. He never exposed anything we didn't already know, and he was silent on September the 11th. The public persecution of him set a fatal precedent. The prosecution of him set a fatal precedent, though, and needed to be fought. Absolutely right. That was always my argument when I got into arguments with people about Julian Assange and Edward Snowden and others. Now, Julian Assange, whom I've never met and probably never will meet. Same goes for Edward Snowden. I don't know anything about those guys' intentions. Their intentions might have been incredibly well meant, and I'm sure they were. But we didn't need to be told about massive surveillance on people by the intelligence agencies. We didn't. We knew already. It wasn't groundbreaking stuff that came out of WikiLeaks and Assange and Snowden. So I was never overwhelmed by it, really, you know. Whereas, as I said, friends of the show and friends of mine were convinced that the guy was some sort of messiah, some sort of martyr for the truth. And I never bought into that personally, but that's just my opinion. 26 minutes to the top of the hour, waiting for Stuart Waiton to join us. He better get a move on. We've got a lot to get through today. Hi to David. How you doing, David? Hi to Leopard. Hi to Chris Morell. Richie, the judge referred to Epstein, apparently, the judge in the Assange case, regarding the suicide fears, but accepted the charges of hacking and conspiring. And of course, that's the big fear for Assange, isn't it? That the judge didn't come down on the side of journalism and free speech and say that it was in the public interest to publish the information Assange had. That's a very good point, Chris. The judge didn't do that. The judge said my reason for not consenting to the extradition is because of his mental health and fears that he might commit suicide in the United States. And that's very important. The United States government has 2 weeks, of course, as I mentioned earlier on now, to appeal. And seemingly they're planning on appealing. Where the hell is Stuart Waiton, eh? Where are you, Stuart? Are you with me? Signing in, he says. All right, he's signing in. Keep those tweets coming in. The new Twitter handle for the programme is @1, Richie Allen, all one word. Hi to William Henderson, not thrilled about the news that Scotland goes back to a full national lockdown from midnight this evening. No, mate, I don't imagine you are. It's coming here later on as well. Hi to Bod, how you doing, Bod? Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you as well. Hi to Matt in Western Massachusetts over there on the America's East Coast. He said West Coast there. Hi to my friend Patricia Braunschweiler. How you doing, Patricia? Hi to Charlotte in Burnley. Hi to Proley. Hi to Drag Butler. How you doing, Drag? Hi to Laurie. How you doing, Laurie? Laurie says, Richie, if I was feeling low, and I have been, those jagoffs would be the last ones I'd listen to. Their light at the end of the tunnel is hitting the V train, says Laurie, referring to Keir Starmer and other politicians earlier on talking about the vaccine being the light at the end of the tunnel. That's been the running theme today, politicians and journalists saying, it's tough at the moment, but don't worry about it. We have the vaccine, don't you know? And it won't be long before enough people are vaccinated so that we can start easing up on the old restrictions there. Don't believe a word of it. Hi to Cliff Moore, friend of the programme. How you doing, Cliff? Big year in front of us all, says Cliff. Happy no fear, says Cliff Moore there. Amen, Cliff. It is a very big year. Not going to happen this year. Melodrama. I don't know. Absolutes. Try not to deal in absolutes, but I think it's absolutely a fact that if at some stage people don't start to disobey, to refuse, to turn their backs on those pulling the strings, as John Lee said earlier on, Professor John Lee, the former pathologist, saying that you've got a bunch of people in stage basically holding the entire nation's futures in their hands. Nerdy people, non-practicing nerdy people working on false models, said John Lee. If people don't very soon say, enough's enough, not going along with this anymore, I'm not continuing to destroy my own life and the lives of my family and friends for a pack of lies. I'm not going to do it. We're running out of time for people to say that. Some people think that ship is gone. I don't. Right, more music. And if Stuart Waiton is not there, then I'm giving up on him and I'm moving on, all right? This is a brilliant song from Bruce Springsteen's latest album. It's called The Power of Prayer from the album Letter to You. And it's a great song. Back with more content shortly. Vernon Coleman, Dr. Vernon Coleman in air two. Bruce Springsteen, The Power of Prayer on the Richie Allen Radio Show. The time is exactly 20 minutes to the top of the hour. That's a great tune from a great album, really. Do check it out. Letter to You. Let's welcome back to the programme Stuart Waiton. Stuart, welcome back.
Thank you.
This is the third different Skype account we're now connected on. Do you know that? I mean, that's just garbage, Stuart. I love you and I love talking to you, but that's just nonsense, that, isn't it? It's like you're on the run from somebody. Nobody has three Skype accounts. Anyway, I'm glad we connected, mate. Excellent article in Spiked, and we'll talk about that in a minute, about grooming gangs. But before we do that, Professor John Lee was on talk radio today, and he accused the BBC of running a propaganda outfit. And he said it's terribly frustrating and frightening to him that the only people who get a look in on the BBC are people totally committed to lockdown and strict measures. And there are very many learned academic men and women who just can't get a look in anymore. Now, I know your field, of course, is in criminology and sociology. You're an author. I know your field isn't in medicine. But as an academic and as a lecturer, has he got a point? Is that something that concerns you?
I find it very difficult and very frustrating, I suppose, because I don't think that the governments are kind of conspiring to kind of try and, I don't know how to put it really. I don't think it's a conspiracy by governments and experts, but I do think they have taken a particular approach which disqualifies the public in a way that it shouldn't, right? So, for example, I'm not sure still to what extent we should be locking down in terms of how we're doing it. One thing I am sure about, or reasonably sure about, is that it shouldn't have been done with any force. It should have been done through a kind of voluntary process where we have an open discussion and the government informs us as best they can and says, this is what I think we need to do. And I think we need to have these limitations because of this concern we have about the health service and so on. So that's a concern I have, that this has been done where the public are come to be seen as a problem to be managed rather than a communal resource where we can all participate in a bit as much as we can in not only understanding it, but also trying to work out what is the best way to deal with these problems. And in that sense, I do think there is a tendency on the news to feel that if you're not following a certain line, then it's potentially dangerous. And I think that's where it kicks in terms of there not being an open discussion. Because what I would love to see is the different contesting views from different academics, you know, these different people with these different views being brought together on a weekly or a bi-weekly or a monthly basis, and we can watch it, right? And we can participate and we can have a discussion where you're getting people who think the government are completely wrong directly confronting the academics and individuals. Because I suspect the government academics have got a good argument. I expect they've got lots of issues and concerns and approaches that need to be considered, but I suspect some of the critics also have good points, and That's what I think, that's what I feel is lacking, is that more kind of open discussion and framework for discussion, because we've kind of taken an approach that is much more top-down than I think it needs to be. So in that respect, I do think there is an issue, and I do think there is a tendency for news programs and so on to be far too one-dimensional. But one-dimensional because they think they're doing the right thing. They think they're keeping people safe. You know, it's a kind of, they will see this as almost as a state of emergency, if you like, and in a state of emergency, you need to take extreme measures and so on and so forth. But, I mean, I remember, for example, in Scotland, they would do things like they would interview children and get the children to say how wonderful they think Nicola is keeping them safe and things like this. And then somebody pointed out that children can't actually catch this, or you know, it's not going to do the children any harm. And it was a bit Maoist.
Yeah.
It was a bit North Korean in terms of the feel of the whole thing. And certainly that's what the news and certain news channels, and not just the BBC, have tended towards. The government comes out and says masks should be worn in schools, and then magically you go down and they interview three kids, and all the three kids, all adorned with their masks,
say,
"We love masks," you know, and my partner looks at me raging because she knows that her son and all her son's friends hate the masks with a passion and don't want to wear them, and yet magically the only kids that they can find are these ones. So they feel as if they're doing the right thing. I think they feel as if they're trying to help the government with a message, and so I think it's part of a more there's something patronizing, I think, about a kind of more expert-led society at the minute.
Yeah, I see that compartmentalization as well. I don't imagine that producers in BBC offices are part of some wider conspiracy. Where our opinions differ, and they are, my opinions are just opinions, where we kind of part company is, I think there is something sinister going on. And I do love the fact that Spiked Online, and I'm finding this more and more, is providing writers like yourself and others with a wide variety of opinions. You know, there are people writing for Spiked who see things maybe a bit more similar to the way I see them. And then I like that. No, what I think, you know, I look back to March when Chris Whitty was categorical in his statement that masks are pretty much useless, that they're not going to do any good. And then a short time later, we should wear the masks. Whitty was the guy who said, this thing is really not going to affect the vast, vast majority of the population. It's a very, very vulnerable and a very old. And yet we have these lockdowns that kill people, and I see it a bit different, but that's neither here nor there. I get to have my say all the time, so I'm not going to argue with you. What I do want to talk about, Edo Stewart, is that piece in Spiked today. It's an excellent read, really. Just to set it up, Stuart Wainton is our guest, by the way. Stuart is an author, a criminologist, lecturer at Abertay University in Dundee. He's obviously not from Dundee, of course. You can hear that Geordie accent there. We will talk a bit of football in a few minutes' time. Very interesting stuff coming out of Uruguay. We'll get to that in a moment. But I did mention to my listeners at the beginning of the programme, Sajid Javid, when he was Home Secretary a couple of years or so ago, commissioned a report into the characteristics of grooming gangs. I don't know what was the catalyst for that report to be commissioned, whether it was, you know, far-right marches. I have no idea what the whole point of it was. But anyway, it was very interesting. It reported just before Christmas. The press didn't pay a lot of attention to it, except in the case of The Independent and The Guardian. And strangely, those newspapers said that the report concluded that most grooming gangs are made up of white men. Now, I've interviewed Sarah Champion. I've interviewed Detective Maggie Oliver. I've gotten into this in great depth over the years. And that didn't make any sense to me. You've written about it brilliantly in Spiked Online. It didn't make any sense to you either, Stuart.
No, well, it's kind of it's the dangers of Facebook. Basically, what happened with this, and I've been conscious of this as a kind of issue in the background. I've lived in an Asian area in Glasgow, where I had lots of good neighbours and all the rest of it that were Asians, Muslims, and so on, but also saw some issues that I thought were problematic, certainly in terms of how the police and other authorities seem to kind of kowtow a little bit to community leaders, which I thought was a bit problematic. So I've kind of had half an eye on this and half an eye on the news coverage, which over the last sort of 5, 6, 7 years, just to, or the lack of news coverage, which I often thought was interesting, where there'd be a news story in the Times, page 36, 12 men, etc., etc., done for 100 underage girls and all the rest of it. And you're thinking, wow, that's quite a big story to have hidden away on page 36. So I was always a little bit questioning about this. But basically what happened was a Facebook friend posted the Guardian newspaper article, which, as you say, had this headline, "Most Child Sexual Abuse Gangs Made Up of White Men." And my Facebook friend, who often tries to sort of show that racism's everywhere, posted this and said, "There you go. What do you have to say about this?" Right. And I kind of looked at it and went, "That's interesting." So basically, I read the report. And then from the report, I read the research that was the basis of the report. So what's happened is the Home Office has produced a piece of research. And essentially, it's just a cobbled together piece of research based on 5 other pieces of research. And I looked at it and their findings, some of them would find, so the a majority of 3 of the 5 found that there were more white people than Asian people involved in this grooming gang situation. 2 of them didn't, 2 of them found the other way around. But the thing I thought was remarkable, even, and there's all sorts of problems with the research in terms of how it's, is it statistically justifiable and all the rest of it. But the thing I thought was remarkable was that none of them factored in the what would seem to me an obvious thing that you need to factor in, which is that there are 21 times more white people in Britain than Asian people. So when you're looking at statistics, you should at least acknowledge that if, for example, you find, 30% of crimes of this nature had white people and 28% had Asian people, you should at least then bear in mind that, yeah, but at the same time, there are 21 times more white people than South Asian people. So, and they hadn't done this.
Why did they not do that? See, this is basic stuff. I'm not an academic like you.
I thought about this, and I am going to do it. I am actually going to try and track down the authors of this research and ask them, because it just seems like an obvious miss. Yeah. Right? So, for example, in the first piece of research, they find 30% are white, 28% are Asian. Right? And you go, right, okay. But, in terms of proportion of the population, that would mean that the Asian representation is massive, right? Because, if there's 21 times more white people, you'd expect there to be 20 more times white people for every crime, right? And if there aren't, then you've got to ask questions about this. So, and there's all sorts of, as I say, the statistics aren't great, trying to draw firm, absolute conclusions. I mean, as I say in my article, I do not think in any matter of means that this tells us that Muslim men are more prone to be paedophiles because, there's all sorts of child abuse takes place by,
absolutely.
Doesn't matter what your colour your skin is. But when it does come to these particular types of crimes where you have a group of men, especially older men, kind of preying on local, often kind of relatively poor, underprivileged white girls, then as far as I can see, if you factor in the population differences, then in all of their research, it suggests that there is a genuine issue here. And it's one that I suspect they are constantly trying to play down because they don't trust the British public to handle the truth. They don't believe that this issue can be discussed openly because they think it's a far-right issue, that it is an issue that is prone to encourage racism, and they don't want to encourage racism, and I can sympathise with that. I don't want to encourage racism either, but I don't think you can hide the truth, and I don't think hiding from the truth has ever done anyone any favours.
And you're a criminologist, George. It does the opposite. You're a criminologist, no better man to answer this question. Could they, and I say could it be argued, I know you're not going to give me a yes or no answer to this, but could it be argued that by adopting this approach of, you know, ignoring it to a certain degree, you know, talking about inflaming racism, could it be argued that by doing that, you're actually putting people in danger? You're putting girls at risk.
Yeah, I'll give you an answer. Yes, I think that is true. I think if it raises a wider question, you see, and the wider question, which has been raised, and it was raised in one of the reports, you know, so some of the reports are raising decent questions, and one of the reports was raising a question about is there a problem where the local authorities kind of, they deal with community leaders, and, you know, they just go through these so-called community leaders, and in that respect, rather than treating everybody equally, you actually go through a conduit, you know, instead of, you know, every single community being engaged with by the police and other services as they would and should be, you actually kind of ask the local community leader what they think about an issue before you actually go in. And of course, this was what was raised about Rotherham, wasn't it?
The whole
question about Rotherham was raising this question. And in that respect, you know, my focus of kind of anger, if you like, about this issue is almost less, you know, the communities themselves that are being targeted, but the authorities, because the authorities, to me, appear to have relinquished authority. You know, they seem to have stepped back from certain communities, or potentially have stepped back. And I experienced this. I was at a community council once in an area in Glasgow where I lived. And one of the Labour councillors, who was an Asian Labour councillor, described himself as a representative of the Asian community. And I chirped up and I said, well, excuse me, you're not a representative of the Asian community. You're representative of the community. You represent me. Right? You don't just represent, and the police that were in the room, you could see, were kind of giggling behind their hands because they would not challenge that.
Yeah.
Right. But yet that was how it was presented. So you had these Labour councillors acting as representatives of the Muslim community. And there is no Muslim community to be represented, right? Unless they want to set up a party called the Muslim Party.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? You see what I mean? So that's what I think is really concerning and needs to be addressed, is whether the authorities have actually stood back, you know, because they feel, oh, we shouldn't, it's their community and it's their values or whatever else is going on. And they haven't been adopting the kind of rigorous approach towards these kind of issues that they might have been doing in other areas where they don't feel uncomfortable about the kind of the community or the values or the, you're trying to walk on eggshells.
Huge problem, Stuart? Stuart Wainton is our guest, sociologist and criminologist, lecturing at Abertay University in Dundee. I've just tweeted a link to this excellent article again. At no point in the piece, as Stuart has said, does he lend, or does he lean towards, or even suggest that if you're from Asia, if your heritage, if your ethnicity is Asian, that you're more likely to be an abuser of children. None of that whatsoever. It's a very forensic, very well written piece talking about this Home Office report what it doesn't discuss, what it's reluctant to discuss, and then the media's characterisation of it. He writes, though, Stuart, The Guardian and much of the modern elite would appear to be more interested in telling us what they think we need to hear rather than being open and honest about an issue in society that raises uncomfortable questions. Before we move on swiftly, we could do all day. I mean, next time you come on, we'll have a longer segment. You'll have one Skype account that you'll stick with and you'll delete the others, and we'll just get on at the right time for a change. But before we get on to other issues about race, You say community there. What a fascinating exchange with that gentleman, that representative. Isn't this a big problem? I was lambasted quite rightly by a very good friend of the radio programmes called Andy Hunter. Andy's in the US now, in Florida. He's a gay man. And Andy said to me a few years ago, he said, Richie, stop saying the LGBT community. Stop, he said. What's this community bullshit? He said, there is no community. And I know you've gotten into this in the past. This assigning everybody to communities is a problem, because then you're generalising all the time and you're not really focusing on individual cases. That's a big problem, right?
Yeah, well, it's a big problem as well. It's a big problem developing in law with the kind of hate crime framework, yeah, because they just adopt this as a real thing. So every black person is defined as part of a vulnerable community.
Yeah.
Every gay person, and of course, you go and ask a gay person if you think that, you know, do you think you should be defined as part of a vulnerable community? And they'll say, of course I bloody don't. So right. It's patronizing as well. It's a new caricature. I mean, that's what's so horrible and wacky about it, is it's a degenerate representation of an entire body of people, right? It recreates the kind of prejudices of the past to a certain extent, but just gives it a positive tick rather than a cross, you know. So what, all women are vulnerable, you know, all black people are part of a vulnerable community, all gay people are part of a vulnerable community. So you construct and recreate divisions in society that then reinforced through law. And of course you get it on television all the time. So, you know, to be good, you know, blackness is good. Right. So, you know, let's have Sky Sports and let's have every second person be black.
Yeah.
And so on. And it becomes a kind of forced issue where, yeah, it kind of moralizes the issue of color. Whereas I think most people just want color blindness, you know, just like choose the person because they're the best. I don't care what color they are, what creed they are, what anything they are. Just choose them because they're the best. Right. Stop hectoring me and lecturing me and trying to tell me this is good and that's bad, because it creates a new division in society, which is really, really unhelpful.
Yeah, and I won't get all conspiratorial on you, but I think, again, it suits certain agendas. You know, I believe it, you know, divide and conquer was always how, I say this now as a genuine dyed-in-the-wool socialist, is how we've been controlled and corralled and kettled. Identity politics and divide and conquer. You're quite right. And I find it kind of amusing. I don't get angry about these things, no more than you do. But as a, you know, dedicated football supporter, as you are, to see a constant, every time I turn on BT or Sky or the BBC now, it's increasingly more black and Asian presenters and pundits and women. And I just find this very amusing. I'm scary at the same time, you know, for the future and where this might end up. But on this whole thing about kind of lunacy just passing as normal, I'm a Manchester United fan, but it doesn't matter. I lived in Spain for years. I know what Negrito means. I know this because I saw this in action when I worked in Spain. I'll never forget, Stuart, I tell this story all the time. I'm in the Kempinski Hotel in Marbella. I'm sitting down in the canteen underneath the hotel where the staff have their meals. I'm doing a radio gig at a radio station based in the hotel. And a Spanish girl gets up to answer the telephone. She answers it and then she shouts down the canteen, "Hey, negro," she says. And so, of course, a black kid gets up, runs to the phone. He pushes her, she pushes him. Bit of flirtation, bit of jostling. They're all pals. And I'm sitting next to a black guy called Sonny, who's originally from Central America, but he's actually lived all his life in New York. And I look at him, you know, I do the real lefty thing. I look at him with my mouth hanging open. Did I just witness that? And Sonny said, "What? What did you witness? What?" I said, "She called him negro." She said, "Yeah, she's his pal." She's referring to him by a characteristic. And I said, Jesus. Anyway, Edinson Cavani has been fined £100,000, kicked out of the game for 3 games, because a very close friend of his says, well done, son, after United won a game recently. And he says, gracias, Negrito. Stuart, this can't continue, because where this goes is a very bad place.
Yeah, I know. It's there's something really particularly weird about it. The thing I found really kind of almost upsetting about this, because this has been rumbling for a few weeks, was I watched the game where he came on and transformed the game, and he was a genius. It was beautiful watching him play, because his movement was so clever. His touch, I think he scored. Did he score two? I can't remember.
Scored two very late on. Yeah,
he was absolutely magnificent. It was. I just looked and thought, wow, this guy, this is brilliant, that money you've got this guy, because this guy is world-class, genuinely world-class, brilliant to watch. And then within no time at all, because this was then his mate then tweets him or whatever he did, in no time at all, it's completely sullied by a debate about this rather than what we should be discussing, which was the beautiful play, and that, you know, that this guy is a genius, right? That's what we should have been discussing, but we weren't discussing that. It was so depressing. I found it so depressing, because it's so unhelpful. Nobody thinks this guy is being racist, you know. They know it's his mate and all the rest of it, but there's football in particular, there's such a kind of leash around football and footballers and everyone associated with it. It's just really destructive and unhelpful. You know what I mean? This should have just disappeared into a nothingness, because it is nothing. He's not. It's his mate who he's just having a bit of crack with. Really, really depressing. But, you know, let's try and, you know, I think we should just, whenever anyone says this, we should just show the goals and say, look, this is what football's about, you know. It's this.
Yeah,
his
international teammates have come out very strongly today and kind of put together a scathing statement about the UK. And, you know, I mean, the UK kind of, the Football Association hung itself, because it acknowledged that in Cavani's culture, that this is a very informal, very matey reference, but that's not good enough. He has to know how it might be perceived everywhere else. Well, I would say two words to that, and the second one would be off. Why does he have to?
I think what's interesting about this as well is that we claim to be a multicultural society.
Yeah,
but when someone else's culture doesn't quite match a culture of the authorities, not even the culture of the people, but the culture of these elites, then they're stamped upon. You know, they're crushed. And so it shows the nonsense of any level of tolerance towards anything that goes against this kind of absolutist, kind of almost Maoist approach to language.
Listen, it's great to have you on the program. You should come back more often. We we'll have more time next time. We'll hook up hours in advance of the show to make sure we're bang on time. Stuart's a brilliant writer. Check his books out. Sociology, Criminology at Abertay University in Dundee. Spike-online.com. No Asian Grooming Gangs Are Not a Myth is the title of that article, which is very, very well written indeed. Thanks for coming back today, mate. Happy New Year to you and yours. I can't wait to speak to you again.
Cheers.
Cheers, Stuart. Gentlemen there, Stuart Waiton, live on the line from, as I said, Dundee this evening. But he might not be. He might be in the northwest with the situation as it is at the moment with respect to students and lockdowns and all the rest of that. He's probably in the northeast. Maybe he is. Right. We're going to do this. Then we'll come back. I'll read some more of your comments. And Dr. Vernon Coleman will then wing in and return to the programme. Can't wait to hear from him.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyursky.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to the program. Don't ever forget.
The views and opinions expressed on The Richie Allen Show are those of the guests and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect the position of the host or other contributors.
Lovely. Now, Spiro Skouras has been in touch. I don't need to tell you who Spiro is. Regular contributor to this program, activistpost.com. Very good reporter. And he sent me a link to a story in the Daily Mail, which I didn't see before coming on air. So thanks a million for doing that, Spiro. He often does that, to be fair to him. He's well aware of what live radio is all about, you see. And I don't have any producer. I certainly don't have any editor. But the Daily Mail published, that is the Daily Mail Online, published a story this afternoon around about 4 o'clock. The headline is, Portuguese health worker dies 2 days after getting the Pfizer COVID vaccine. Her father says he wants answers. The lady's name is Sonia Acevedo. Suffered a sudden death on New Year's Day, 2 days after getting the jab. Her mother worked, Mrs. Acevedo. She worked in paediatrics at a hospital in Porto. No side effects after getting the vaccine, so no immediate side effects, but dropped dead 2 days later. An autopsy is imminent. Thanks so much for letting me know that, Spiro. Of course, you can't jump, and by you I don't mean Spiro, of course, because he hasn't done that. I can't, and you can't or shouldn't jump the shark and get all excited now. First of all, you shouldn't be excited about the death of anybody, but don't be making assumptions. Don't be making assumptions, as it were. We don't know. It's obviously very interesting and very concerning, and people should know about it. That developing news this afternoon, a Portuguese health worker working in paediatrics, Sonia Acevedo, 41-year-old woman, didn't have any immediate side effects having received the first dose of the Pfizer COVID vaccine, but she died 2 days later. Her father is demanding answers. My next guest needs very little introduction. Great man. Best-selling author. Too many books to mention. Practiced as a GP with great distinction. Wrote national newspaper columns for many, many years. Much loved columns as well. These days you can find him on brandnewtube.com, where he presents the brilliant, the funny, often funny it must be said, but very serious and very important, An Old Man in a Chair, where he dissects and cuts through government pronouncements about coronavirus and pokes holes in them, which is a great service, I think, to you and to me. Let's welcome back to the programme our great friend, Dr. Vernon Coleman, and Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year, Richie, and Happy New Year to everybody listening. Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming on. Before we talk about what Boris Johnson is likely to say this evening, Vernon, that is a story of interest. I suppose people shouldn't read too much into it until there is an autopsy, but it's very important that people know that a woman who received the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine has died 2 days later, a woman who worked in paediatrics. What do you think?
Well, the other day, wasn't there someone who fell very ill after a couple of hours after and died of a heart attack? And the authorities immediately said, oh, we don't think this is linked to the vaccine. Now, the strange thing is that if you test positive, and that's a joke in itself, if you test positive for COVID-19 and you die within 28 days, then it's the COVID which killed you. But if you have the vaccine and you die within 2 hours or whatever, then it's nothing to do with the vaccine. It's just one of those little coincidences that we have to get used to. The lies keep on coming. The lies and deceit are so great, I have a job just to keep up with what they're saying next. It's absolute garbage. Anybody who believes what's happening must be moronic. The nonsense. There was a guy called Montgomery, who said the other day that anybody who didn't wear a mask had blood on their hands.
Yeah.
That's what he said on the BBC. Now, the amazing thing was, of course, I totally think he's talking rubbish because it's the other way around. The people who tell folk to wear masks, they're the ones who've got blood on their hands because of all the people who are going to die this year of bacterial pneumonia. But I tell you what, this guy Montgomery, there's a few questions I'd like to ask him if I was ever lucky enough to be on the same programme as him. For example, he is a director with two other doctors, unless there's another Hugh Edward Montgomery out there who's medically qualified, and according to the GMC, I couldn't find one. He is a director of a company called Pantair. Can't believe it, can you? But there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is registered at apartment 55, 366. I won't tell you the rest of the address, but I've got it. It was incorporated. This is the key. I can even tell you when they bought the flat. But this was incorporated on the 3rd of January, 2020. Now, and the company is officially classified as the manufacturer of medical and dental instruments and supplies. This is the guy who said that anyone who doesn't wear a mask has blood on their hands. And Montgomery and the two other doctors, they've got between 25 and 50% of the shares each, so it's a reasonable guess that they've got a third of the shares each, but I'm guessing. Now, the interesting thing is that they're running this company from a flat. I don't know whether they've got planning permission for manufacture of medical and dental instruments and supplies, but how did they know on the 3rd of January 2020 that it would be a whizzo idea to form a company? And what sort of supplies are they making or selling from their flat in Southwest 11? Could it possibly be? Oh, the other interesting thing is I couldn't find a website or a phone number. So who are they selling this stuff to? I'd like to ask Dr. Montgomery whether he's importing stuff. Are there any masks involved? How did he know? How is he so brilliant as to know on the 3rd of January, ages, weeks and weeks and weeks before anybody else in the government or elsewhere spotted that there was a problem, how did he know we were going to need, that it was a worthwhile thing to set up a company for medical supplies and instruments?
We need to find out more, but of course this is the job of national newspaper journalists and national television producers to find this stuff out, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I got quite a long way, and not very long. I found out that the flat had been bought for 570,500 quid on the 30th of May 2017. I found out quite a lot. I know how old all the doctors are. I know their GMC registration status. Two of them are registered and one isn't. I want to know what on earth Montgomery was doing saying that people who don't wear masks have blood on their hands. Has he never heard of hypoxia, hypercapnia, bacterial pneumonia, and all the other problems related to that? And what the hell's going on with this damned stupid vaccine that they're talking about now? If you can't have two jabs with the same stuff in, then you can have mix and match. You can have another vaccine. Whether or not, I mean, this is just lunacy. Any doctor who does this should be struck off. In America, I wrote this down, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has noted that the authorized COVID-19 vaccines are not interchangeable and that the safety and efficacy of a mixed product series has not been evaluated. A vaccine expert at Cornell University said, and I quote, Britain seems to have abandoned science completely now and are just trying to guess their way out of a mess. People are going to have different made vaccines. I'm speechless. Any doctor who promotes this or does this, they should be struck off instantly. They don't know what's going to happen with the vaccines. An astrologer could give you a better advice than I can, or any doctor can. There isn't a doctor in the world who can tell you definitively what's going to happen to the patients who have these vaccines in a year's time. There is no way of knowing. And how many people are going to die? I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. It's just It's just beyond compare the absolute cruelty of this and the hysteria of people supporting the government. It's mass hysteria. It's like mass Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
And they want to push now from today. They're going to push this AstraZeneca. Now, I don't think you, Richie, have got any more faith than me in the licensing authorities in the UK. That's the ones who took just under £1 million from Bill Gates.
That's right.
In a financial association. So do we trust the licensing authority? I don't. Do we trust the government? I don't. So what about AstraZeneca? Let me repeat, if I might, what I think I mentioned on this programme several months ago about AstraZeneca, because this is the company we're being asked to trust. In the last 6 years, this is just a small amount of the problems that I've found. They agreed to pay $110 million to settle two lawsuits claiming that they had fraudulently marketed two drugs. The Texas Attorney General said that the company's alleged actions were especially disturbing because of the well-being of children and the integrity of the state hospital system were jeopardized. This is the company we have to trust. AstraZeneca said it denied any wrongdoing, but still paid out $110 million for not doing anything wrong. Then they had to pay out $350 million to resolve 23,000 lawsuits. They were charged with illegal marketing, including corrupt data in studies, a sex scandal, a poorly run clinical trial that was alleged to could have compromised patient safety and data reliability. They did a study for a trial that originally included 30 children, but only 8 children completed the trial, and the results were inconclusive, but they published the trial anyway, and then recommended that the drug be used as the leading choice for children. One of the researchers was paid at least $238,000 in consulting fees.
Yeah.
Then there was a company email which said, open quotes, "Thus far we have buried trials 15, 31 and 56. The larger issue is how do we face the outside world when they begin to criticize us for suppressing data," close quotes. And then they paid, AstraZeneca paid $520 million fine and $647 million to settle global lawsuits. There was another scandal. And it goes on and on and on. I'm sorry, it'll get boring. But it goes on and on and on. And this is the company that we are expected to trust. We're expected to trust a licensing authority which has done a financial deal with Bill Gates. We are expecting to trust a government which has lied so much that I doubt if any of them would notice the truth if it bit them on the leg. And we're expected to trust AstraZeneca, which I wouldn't trust to sell boot polish. That's the position we're in at the moment, with the mainstream media being totally silent about all this. As far as I know, the BBC hasn't even mentioned the fact that Britons may well have two different vaccines. And how is a vaccine supposed to work on a virus which has mutated? Don't they make a different flu virus if the flu virus mutates? In my opinion, it's like saying we're going to give you a vaccine against chickenpox, but we hope it'll help you against measles.
Yeah, they've said that the very nature of the mRNA jab and its uniqueness, because it's new, is that rather than have to go through the whole process again of designing a vaccine for the mutation, they've really only got to change something in the vaccine's code. And they can do it very quickly. But before you come back on that, I do want to address one thing. I've taken a bit of stick, not for speaking with you, but for speaking with lots of scientists and doctors. And when you say that they don't know, the manufacturers nor the government has any idea what the effects of the vaccine will be on people, and when I don't challenge that, I get hammered and people say I should challenge that, because even if the testing was very rapid, the fact is that some testing was done. Now, my response to my critics is, what Dr. Vernon Coleman is saying is, if you rush testing to get a vaccine through in 8 or 9 months, you cannot possibly know what the effect of the vaccine will be on somebody's body in 18 months, 3 years, 5 or 7 years down the line. That's what he's saying. That's why I don't challenge it, because he's right. They can't possibly know the impact of that vaccine on the body in 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years' time. So I want to put that one to bed, because I'll take a criticism when I deserve it. I'm not challenging that, because there's no need to challenge it. You're 100% right. Nobody knows what this vaccine will do to the bodies of the people who get it over a period of a decade, let alone 5 years. So you're bang on there. Very important. But on the mutation thing, this is what scares me, Vernon. Dr. Vernon Coleman, by the way, vernoncoleman.com. This is what really scares the bejesus out of me on the mutation, is that they're talking about a mutation in South Africa. Hancock went public today and said the South African mutation could be absolutely catastrophic for everybody. They're talking about a mutation coming maybe from America. And they say the mRNA technology is wonderful because they just have to fine-tune the existing vaccine in a matter of weeks and bingo, we've got another vaccine for you. My fear is that the vaccines we have now will turn into 10, will turn into 12, will turn into 15 vaccines and will never be out of a doctor's surgery. We'll be constantly taking vaccines. That's my fear.
Exactly. And it was predictable 9 months ago that the stuff mutates. Everything mutates. And is anybody saying that they're going to test every single person that they vaccinate to see which particular strain of coronavirus they've got? Of course they're not going to. And what about the fact that they did not test it, as far as I'm aware, and I've been looking at it, I can't find any evidence that they tested this vaccine on 80-year-olds or 70-year-olds. And yet that's who they're giving it to. And 80-year-olds and 70-year-olds are quite different physiologically. A lot of drug companies are wise enough to say that if you're giving prescription drugs to elderly patients, you should give them a different dose to the dose that you would give to a 22-stone builder, for example, who's 50 years old. Of course they have to be different. This isn't science. The science went out of the door months and months and months ago. There's been no science. And these are the things that I have been dying to debate, because I will back myself against anybody they want to put up that's in the government. I'm not going to debate with some GP from somewhere, because that's a waste of time. I want to debate with somebody in the government, with Witty or Valance, the guy with all the shares in GlaxoSmithKline. Really pissed because they haven't got a vaccine out yet. And what about Montgomery, this professor who said that we've got blood on our hands if we don't wear a mask? Come on, let's show some balls, Mr. Dr. Montgomery. Debate with me. Tell me why I'm wrong when I produce 100 items of scientific evidence proving that masks do more harm than good. They damage the brain. If you wear a mask more than 2-3 hours, it's causing you massive hypoxia and you're breathing in all sorts of bugs. During the next year, I make a forecast. And incidentally, I'm about to put back up the one that YouTube took down, the very first video I made, in which I think just about every forecast I made in March 2020 has come true. So here's a forecast for 2021. There will be an increase this year in the total number of deaths. There was virtually no difference between the total death total, between the death totals in the UK for 2018, 2019 and 2020. And yet, this coming year, I predict that there will be a higher death total in the UK than there was last year. Now, they will say it's because of COVID. It isn't. I'll tell you what it is. It's because of all the people who've died because of the lockdowns, and even the government admitted that would be 150,000 to 200,000 deaths extra.
Minimum.
And it's all the people who are going to die from the vaccine, because they are never going to admit that the vaccine's killed anybody. That's what's going to happen this year. By the end of this year, there will be more deaths, I predict, than there were in 2020, 2019, 2018. Those 3 years are very similar, despite the fact that we've had a plague. We've had a plague, but it hasn't killed any more people, even though they've been fiddling the figures. The masks, the vaccine, and the lockdowns will kill so many people, they'll be able to blame it on this non-existent plague, the well-marketed flu, which they have been marketing brilliantly, I have to admit, since March, but which is not a plague. And don't forget that in March, I think it was the 20th, 21st, the link's on my website, the government's advisory committees, committee on dangerously infective diseases said that the coronavirus could be downgraded to flu level. No mainstream media, to my knowledge, has ever admitted that.
Never.
It was off the notifiable diseases report. It had been put on at the beginning of March, and before the end of March, it was taken off because it was decided, no, this isn't a big killer. We don't need to worry about this one. And if you look at the government's website, it's all there. The lies just keep... Look at the PCR test. The PCR test, a court in Portugal... I'm just sort of... My brain's going here.
No, you're very good. This is brilliant. Only 7 or 8 weeks ago, a Portuguese court determined that the PCR tests... I will say this and then I'll shut up and get out of your way. It said, the Portuguese court, if you have a PCR test... And if it tells you you have coronavirus, there is a 97% chance the result is wrong. That's what it said.
The appeal court in Portugal upheld it. There were 4 German tourists who were held in quarantine, and they managed to get the court to overrule it. And the court said, you can't lock people up for this because it's a load of bollocks. This test is absolute rubbish. It's so unreliable. There's so many false positives. And that's the test that they're using to tell us that we've got to be locked down, we're put under house arrest all over the UK. We've got to be put under house arrest because of a test which is so unreliable that the courts in Portugal have thrown it out.
Thrown
a
it
test
out.
Which produces more false positives than real positives. And they're doing this test more and more, and they're finding more and more false positives. So they're doing more and more lockdowns. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why hospitals are short of staff, because they test the poor sods every day and they're finding loads and loads. And we've got the cycles increased so much to 35, 40 cycles, so that this exponentially increases the amount of viral DNA in the sample. So you're almost certain to get loads and loads of positives at the level that we're running it in the UK. Other countries are doing it at 25 to 30 cycles. We're doing it at 35 to 40 cycles. It's no wonder we're getting tons of false positives. And this is the science they're talking about. This is what they call science.
And it's disgusting? Do you know what's really upsetting about that? They brought out the new the other test, the lateral flow test. And they screamed about how great this was and how quick it was and how reliable it was. And they're using the lateral flow test, and it's not finding the virus in very many people because most people don't have the virus. And now there's a concerted effort or a concerted campaign to demonise their own lateral flow test because it's not giving them the results they want. Can I just read a couple of comments? Because this is huge interest, as always, in Dr. Vernon Coleman. Philip said to me earlier today, knowing you were coming on, Richie, I was shocked to learn that my friend's father caught COVID-19 in hospital while waiting to die from vascular dementia. He died a couple of days ago, and we were told basically he will be classed as a COVID death, even though he was dying before he caught coronavirus. Why is this not being questioned at the top level, says Philip?
Well, it's not being questioned because it's what they want to happen. It's what they're deliberately doing. If you die within 20, I've said this before, but I'll say it again. If you die within 28 days of testing positive because you're run over by a bus or because a mad axeman hits you over the head, if you die within 28 days of testing positive, you died of COVID-19. That's the attempt to push up the rate. I sometimes get the feeling that Britain's being particularly punished compared to the rest of the world because we dared to vote Brexit. This, of course, you have to go back to the whole Agenda 21 and find out why. What the devil are they doing this for? They are falsely and deliberately exaggerating the number of people. The number of deaths from COVID-19 is almost the same now as the number of deaths that you would get from flu. in a season. Flu seasons go from October to beginning of May or whatever, sometimes something like that, and that can kill 650,000 people around the world. But now in the UK, hardly anybody dies of flu anymore, but the number of deaths from COVID almost matches, it's the same all the world round, all the way around the world. And now they've managed to mix, though they haven't completely mixed it so that it's not so obvious, but they're sort of putting the COVID-19 deaths in with the flu deaths and in with the pneumonia deaths, and that will mean in with the deaths of the people who got bacterial pneumonia, which is recognized globally as a major problem now because of people wearing masks, wearing them all day long, picking them up off the pavement, which I've seen twice, and putting them back on. The bacterial pneumonia is killing people, and that's being put down as COVID-19. The deceits, the dishonesties, everywhere. It's absolutely vile. And companies, of course, are catching in on it. What was that Ryanair slogan? Jab and die?
Yeah, jab and fly. Yeah, yeah.
Jab and die, whatever. And it was O'Leary, of course. O'Leary just happens to be on the Bilderberg.
The Bilderberger,
committee.
Yeah.
What a surprise that was. When I first saw the O'Leary, who I'd always thought of a bit of a rebel, when I thought that he was doing this jab and fly and sucking up to the government, I thought, this isn't the guy that I thought sucked up to the government. Then I found out he was on the Bilderberg committee. What a joke. What an absolute scandal. This guy should be, I don't know.
And if anybody wants to know more about Bilderberg, Tony Gosling has an amazingly brilliant website called Bilderberg.org, which is, nobody has ever really archived the Bilderberg meetings as well as Tony has. So I recommend people check that out. 24 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. 20-second clip, Dr. Vernon Coleman. This is former Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt saying that these restrictions need to go on until Easter, because by then those who might die from coronavirus will have been inoculated. Jeremy Hunt.
Do you need to vaccinate all those who could potentially die if they get the virus? And it looks like we'll be able to reach most of those people by Easter. And I think that's why I think this time, funnily enough, it's an easier decision to agree to a version of a national lockdown, because there is that light at the end of the tunnel.
Light at the end of the tunnel. We need a national lockdown starting tonight until Easter so that we can get millions of people vaccinated. This is,
He went to the same medical school as Gary Lineker and Bill Gates, because he's suddenly become an expert, has he? I noticed the phrase potentially die. We can all potentially die of anything. That's such bollocks. They keep doing it, don't they? This is a deliberate policy. It'll be all right by the summer. It'll be all right by the autumn. It'll be all right by Christmas. We've all heard it. Now it'll be all right by Easter. Then it'll be all right by the summer. It'll be all right by November. I tell you this, it'll never be all right unless we make them make it all right, because this country, we have become cowardly. We have become collaborative. We have endorsed stupid policies. We've put up with all sorts of absolute garbage. We've allowed them to get away with nonsense such as this. There is no plague in Britain. A plague would have massively increased the total death rate. There has been no massive increase in the total death rate. And this nonsense about asymptomatic spread of COVID. Did you see that report? Of course you did. The report from China. Now, this wasn't just one of your piddly little surveys that the BBC loves so much. This was a study of nearly 10 million people in China, a proper study. In fact, it wasn't 10 million. I apologise to the BBC fact checkers. It was 9,899,828. I've got it written.
Yeah, yeah.
People in the study, they found 300 asymptomatic cases. They did contact tracing, which is easy in China. And of those 300, not one case of COVID was detected. A total of 1,174 close contacts of the asymptomatic positive cases were traced, and they all tested negative for COVID-19. The conclusion really is that there's no such thing as asymptomatic spread of COVID-19, which is pretty obvious when you think about it. They tell us that the danger is coughing and sneezing. Well, if you're not coughing and sneezing, how are you spreading it? That's the big question that nobody seems to bother to answer.
Right, can you settle an argument then? Settle an argument for me. Before this garbage, before this massive lie about the plague, was it conventional thinking that if you didn't have any symptoms, that you couldn't pass a virus onto somebody? Like, I might have some flu in my system, but if I'm not sneezing and I'm not coughing, I'm not going to give it to anybody. Was that how things were seen before COVID?
If it's not a contagious, if it's contagious, obviously you can pass it on by touching. But nobody's ever said, really, that COVID's contagious. It's infectious. Yeah, cough and sneeze. Put your hand in front of your mouth if you've got a cough. I was terrified last summer because I've not ever worn a mask. That's not true. I put a scarf over my face when I went in for a dental checkup because they wouldn't let me in the building. And I put it over my face for about 5 yards until I was under surgery.
Yeah.
But I have never worn a mask. And in the summer, I get hay fever. And in the summer, I was sneezing away in supermarket, yelling out, "It's just hay fever, it's just hay fever," before anybody came up and lynched me. But the fact is that asymptomatic, I've never believed it. And I'm quite prepared to believe a survey which, listening carefully, BBC fact checkers, 9,899,828 people, and they found that there was no asymptomatic spread. Think of the BBC. Did you notice that they do all these little surveys of people, and then they always find people who support what they want them to think. So they did a survey over the weekend about whether children should be stopped from going to school, as the teachers' unions desperately seem to want to happen, Agenda 21. Well, the BBC managed to interview some women, all women, either way, because this was children going to school. And according to the BBC, obviously only women have anything to do with children, because that's a woman thing, isn't it? Must interview only women by the BBC if we want to talk about cooking and washing up and children and stuff like that. I love it when the BBC screws up, which is about 64 million. So, anyway, the BBC interviewed all these people. There was one person who said, "Well, I really want to go to work, and I can't if the kids have to come." So all the others, "Oh, no, close the schools. Must close the schools. Must close the schools." That's the BBC for you. Really biased, unfair, prejudiced, guaranteed to not tell the truth and to make sure it's really very well hidden. And did you notice also that they're now so short of people to give the jab, to give the vaccines, because obviously somebody's got to do all the jabbing. Now, how the devil they're going to find enough to do the number of jabs that they seem to think they require? They'll be just getting navvies off the building site. Do you think you could give an injection?
They might do. Why not?
The problem that the government's got has been, they've been put in this position by the GMC, the General Medical Council, which has killed more people than Shipman. The General Medical Council, they have a revalidation process which has stopped. Once doctors retire, they can't stay licensed, because in order to keep a license, you have to provide evidence that you're still practicing. So as soon as you retire, you can't provide evidence that you're still practicing. Joseph Heller would have loved this. So you can't provide the reports from colleagues and patients because you're not practicing, so you can't stay licensed. So now the government's stuffed, because they want to bring doctors out of retirement to help with all this injecting. But the doctors out of retirement, most of whom I would say do not approve of this vaccine anyway, because they're old enough and wise enough to know, but they can't come out and do the jabbing because they can't get licensed. They can't get licensed, so they can't get coverage from the Medical Defence Union and so on, because of the General Medical Council, which has created this wonderful fee-earning process called revalidation. So they've stuffed themselves over that as well. Just goes on and on, doesn't it?
It never ends. And when Johnson said this morning, behind a face covering, he was barely intelligible, really, when he said that we'll be announcing new restrictions this evening, I get quite a bit of correspondence, as I know you do, and I had some pretty heartfelt mails from listeners, one from a woman who lives in Rugby, believe it or not, and she said, "I can't go on, Richie. I can't go on anymore. I can't cope with it. I can't continue to live like this, and neither can my husband, and we don't know what to do." It's desperate for people to hear this today, that the country might be going into even further. I mean, it's bad enough as it is, into even more harsh restrictions until Easter time. And it's even harder to put up with that if you know that this is bollocks and if you know that you don't need the vaccine. This is hurting a lot of people. And you always sign off your episodes of an old man in a chair with a beautifully sincere message to remind people that they're not alone. And it's lovely. But there's a lot of people hurting tonight, Vernon. There's a lot of people really upset looking down the barrel of this happening until Easter. And then,
It's deliberate. I'm talking of Johnson with his mask on. I know you saw Johnson and Ma in a room, in a studio, across a table. It didn't look to me like a fix. It looked like they were there. Yeah. They weren't 6 feet apart, and neither of them had masks on. So are they related, we should be told?
Yeah.
I feel so, so sorry for people who are running businesses, but this is deliberate. Make no mistake about it. This continuous extension is part of the deliberate chaos. I've just remembered, by the way, that the Queen, Nick, you are not alone. Did you know that? Apparently in her Queen's speech, I didn't bother to listen to it because she's a complete traitor.
Never misses an episode of an old man in a chair, the Queen, apparently. That's the rumour.
My lawyers will be writing to her. I want me fivepence. The BBC has predicted that tonight there will be 1 hour allowed for exercise, stricter travel. We have to all sit with the windows open, which will get rid of quite a few people. We need to do more hand sanitising, which will cause more health problems because, of course, the FDA, the last time I looked, had decreed that 173 different products named as hand sanitizers were too dangerous to use. And we'll have to wear masks with three layers at work, outdoors, and in school. Now, that's what they're saying. And since the BBC is obviously hand in hand Goebbels to Hitler, then since the BBC says that, we have to assume that's right. Masks with three layers will be more expensive. You can always buy the MCC mask in the MCC colors, just £8, and it's said to be able to keep out pollen and germs and dust, which is really... What stupid, bloody, fashionable nonsense. Masks with three layers, I guarantee, will kill more people because they're thicker, they will hold in more bacteria, and people will be breathing in. If you wear a mask, you must change it 4 times a day or you will kill your brain cells and you will get a serious lung disease. 4 times a day, you must change your mask, and they must be washed. And of course, when you've washed them, they don't work.
No good then. Can we come back to Hugh Montgomery just for a moment while we're on masks?
Tell him I want to debate with him. Tell him I will destroy him. He will never again appear on any radio or television program. By the time I've finished with him, he will be so embarrassed. He will migrate to some little atoll somewhere in some far distant ocean, because I think my personal opinion, my personal opinion is that he's a fool to say that people who don't wear masks have blood on their hands. Sorry, Richie, go ahead.
No, good. What I heard that interview live. I was in local park on New Year's Eve morning. It's either New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, because Campbell had come back from his BBC holiday and with Rachel Burden, who did the interview with Montgomery. And I heard him say that. It was about 5 minutes or 7 minutes past six in the morning. And I would have gone for him, as any semi-decent presenter would have done. I would have said to him, that sort of language is inflammatory, I would have said to him. And it could be argued that it's incitement to violence. And we've seen a lot of violence lately with non-mask wearers being attacked. To me, the guy was inciting retribution against people who were not wearing masks by nature of him saying, if you're not wearing a mask, there's blood on your hands. Very simple translation. You're going to kill somebody if you don't wear a mask. That, in the mind of somebody who's already at their wit's end, terrified of the virus because the government has terrified them, because the BBC has terrified them, that can lead to somebody throwing a punch or worse, at some poor, misfortunate creature who happens to not be wearing a mask because he knows it's futile. He was inciting violence, I think.
He was, and I've seen it happen. I spoke to a tramp in the street just before Christmas, and he couldn't wear a mask. He was in a bad state. He was having trouble breathing, and the poor chap had been beaten up twice for not wearing a mask in the street. And exactly, and what Montgomery didn't seem to know is that a lot of people physically cannot wear a mask. People with asthma, serious chest diseases, heart disease, they can't wear a mask because it'll kill them straight away. Not just in 3 months, 6 months or 10 years' time, it will kill them. But he seems to be saying, and the government says that you don't have to wear a mask if it causes you physical problems or if it causes you anxiety or you're uncomfortable wearing one, you don't have to wear a mask. So why is Montgomery saying the government's wrong, everybody has to wear a mask? Who the hell does this man
he's
think
a
he
useful
is?
Idiot, isn't he? Yeah. He's a useful idiot. And we see them being rolled out every day on Sky and the BBC. If it isn't that pretty little thing, and I don't care how sexist this sounds, Devi Shridhar from Scotland, very fetching young filly, as we might have said some years ago, they're lining up to come on the BBC and Sky to tell us that we have to wear masks or we're going to kill people, we have to stay indoors, we have to accept this, and we have to take the vaccine. And we are going to run out of time in about 5 minutes. I wanted to ask you this. Dr. Vernon Coleman, vernoncoleman.com is the website, bookmark it, brandnewtube.com, which is a bit of a godsend, really, as a channel. Mohammed and the people who run that, well done to them. Brand New Tube, an old man in a chair, you can't miss it. According to the Sunday Times, not that I'm claiming it to be, you know, the bastion of great journalism, but one of its own polls suggests that 25% of adults in this country have no intention of taking the vaccine. So here's my question to you, Dr. Vernon Coleman. On the one hand, we might be buoyed by that. We might be rejuvenated by that news. On the other hand, what will their response be to that, the government?
They'll increase the pressure. They'll increase the scare tactics, which is all that's been happening. This is a long-term game they're playing. They're playing the Agenda 21 game. The idea, I know this sounds mad, but the evidence is there. You've only got to look at the Agenda 21 from the United Nations. You trace it all the way back to the plan to use global warming as a tool to manipulate people and to make people think that we needed a world government and so on and so on. They will ramp it up. They will fiddle the figures yet further. They will do the tests by pushing up the number of cycles. And, of course, they can bring down and push up the number of cycles as much as they like by which the test is done, so they can reduce the number of cases and they can increase the number of cases. Remember, they're bringing in lockdowns. They're putting people under house arrest in the United Kingdom, not because of the number of people who are dying of COVID, because the number of people who are dying of COVID is no more than the number of people who would die of the ordinary flu in an ordinary year. And you can check that out for yourself. The number of people dying is no more. They're not doing the lockdowns because of the number of people dying, what I call the D number. They are using the R number and they're using the test. And the test is rubbish. The test has, as you said, the test has been thrown out of court, literally, by the Portuguese court and also by the upper court in Portugal. Sorry, Portuguese, I forgot what it's called. But they threw out the test and said it's absolute rubbish. You can't take any notice of that. They will say that hospitals, and they bring out all these doctors saying, oh, it's terrible, we're under terrible stress. And yet, the number of hospital beds has gone down by between a third and a half in the last 20 years, during which time, may I say, the number of bureaucrats working for the National Death Service has gone up by just about the same number of people as the number of beds has gone down. The number of beds occupied at the moment, judging by the latest figures I've seen, and the number of ITU beds as well, is no greater and indeed, according to some figures, less than it is normally. What they're doing is saying, look how busy we are. half our staff's not here because they've tested positive. They're not ill, they've tested positive. And what's going to happen in the next few months is that the death rate is going to go up because of all the people who haven't had cancer treatment, all the people who haven't been treated for heart disease, all the people who haven't been treated for any other disease, because hospital departments seem now to regard a coronavirus patient as far more important than any other type of patient. They're not. That's going to increase rapidly from now on and forevermore, or at least for at least a decade. The number of people who are going to die of bacterial pneumonia because they're breathing in constantly polluted air and also fungal infections and other viruses, of course, is going to massively increase because the number of people who have been scared, terrified and bullied into wearing a mask that the evidence shows doesn't do any good but does a hell of a lot of harm. Free book on my website called Proof That Masks Do More Harm Than Good. It's also on the lightpaper.co.uk. So that the masks are killing people, the lockdown is definitely killing, I don't know how many people it'll kill in the end, millions around the world, but that's what they want, of course. They want to reduce the population. And, of course, I firmly believe, and so do a lot of other doctors, I'm no longer alone on this, a lot of doctors believe the vaccine's going to kill a lot of people. Very, very sadly, a lot of elderly people. Remember, this vaccine was never tested on 80-year-olds, and they're giving it to 80-year-olds.
Nor was it tested alongside conventional or everyday medicines that people take. I want to ask you this, because
they never do that with vaccines. They never test it and see, well, how does this get on if you take
with paracetamol or whatever. Let me ask you this: next week, can we get, if you're back next week? That is, look, you've said something there, and I've got to address this. You've said this is what they want. They want to kill people. You've said the vaccine is going to do this. Now, everybody who listens to this programme, they know that I'm sympathetic to those ideas. And I am. So it would be foolish of me to claim otherwise. But the vast majority of people who live amongst us think that is fanciful or downright absurd. And I want to get into that with you next time. I want to ask you, how in the name of God do you convince somebody to take a second look at the claim that this is to lead to a one world government, at the claim that depopulation is some sort of end goal? I think we should explore that a bit more, and I'll be a bit more challenging in the questions I ask. But of course, as usual, you'll get all the time in the world to answer them, if that's okay with you.
Okay, a date next week. Let me just say that in March 2020, I predicted three things in the first video I made. I predicted three things. I said, one, they will kill lots of old people. I said, second, they will aim to, this was in middle of March. I said, they will also aim to bring in mandatory vaccinations. And I said, they will try to introduce, to get rid of cash so that we no longer have the freedom to use cash for whatever we want. I said, those are the three things. Well, what's happened? They've killed a hell of a lot of old people. They are talking of mandatory vaccinations, even though they say, oh, well, it'll only be if you want to go get on an aeroplane or go on a bus or go into a shop or buy any food or have any health care. Otherwise, it won't be mandatory. And, of course, they're trying to get rid of cash. And half the shops you go into now won't take cash because they've been so terrified into thinking that the notes that they're handling have suddenly become very dangerous.
They're more dangerous than
they were a year, 5 years, 10 years ago. That's all rubbish. That was all predicted a year ago, and now I will happily explain next week. It's a date, Richie. We will go into it's a date, God willing. It's a date, God willing, that we will go into exactly why this is deliberate, exactly what they're doing is planned, and I stand by. I've made nearly 200 videos this year, and all the transcripts are on my website. And a lot of them are in the book I did, COVID-19, which is also available free. But the point is that all the predictions I've made are accurate.
At some stage, people have to, well, at some stage, ordinary men and women, and I'm an ordinary man, have to acknowledge that people like you have been making these predictions for a long time, and that you haven't been vague in terms of predicting what is coming down the line. that has come down the line. We're out of time today. We'll do that next week. We'll have plenty of time. We'll have an hour or more to do it. In the meantime, vernoncoleman.com for all the transcripts. Also, brandnewtube.com. You'll see all the episodes of An Old Man in a Chair. I mean, God knows what will happen between now and next week. Things are moving so quickly. But as usual, thanks for your time. Means a lot to me and to my listeners, Vernon. You know that.
My pleasure, Richie. Thanks very much for having me on.
Not at all. Can't wait to speak next week. Dr. Vernon Coleman, brandnewtube.com. And I'm going out of the programme today with this by Jerry Marsden. I met Jerry Marsden a couple of times along my journey in the media over the years. He was a gentleman. You know, he passed away the other day. And I have a lot of friends in Liverpool. I'm no big fan of Liverpool Football Club, but I have a lot of friends in Liverpool. I have a lot of friends in Glasgow as well. So we're going out of the programme with this boy Jerry and the Pacemakers. We will do it all again tomorrow.
When you walk through a storm.